welcome to Quantum of Solace, number 66. And again, we have a special guest, Andy Bannister, who is from Canada, from England. Well, tell us where you're from, Andy.
So, hi, David. Great to be on the podcast. So, so I come from London, in England originally, but the last 6 years, my wife and I have been living in Toronto in Canada. So I work for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and head up the organization there.
Great. And we've mentioned your book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and your videos and all the rest of it. They're really, really great. But since you come from Canada and we're talking about news things,
yep.
Something that's come across our horizons that I don't know much about, but the Canadian fire. Tell us what's happened.
Yes, it's interesting. Actually, the fire up there in Fort McMurray, up in northern Canada, has put Canada on the map in a way. I mean, it's been amazing that I've had people emailing and phoning from, you know, across the world. Even though it's been reported over here on this side of the Atlantic, I don't think has represented the scale. I mean, Fort McMurray is not big. It's a city of maybe 100,000 people, but that's now emptied. I mean, everybody has been evacuated because simply what you've had is there have been wildfires up there quite frequently, but for whatever's happened this time, freak of nature, those fires have burnt incredibly fiercely and have encroached right up to the very edge of the city. Thankfully, they haven't penetrated the city, but there's still the risk it can do. And so simply for public health reasons, safety reasons, we had to evacuate everybody. So cities like Edmonton, and the capital of Alberta, now is full of basically refugees.
Yeah.
And I've got lots of friends in ministries up there and churches up there who are, like a lot of other organizations, I've got their hands full just dealing with tens of thousands of people who can't go home for the foreseeable future. And something like the last figure I saw, about 20% of the housing in the city is either been destroyed or damaged beyond repair.
I mean, I can't envisage such a massive fire. I think what some of us will feel is we're in our homes, we're secure, we hear about fires, you know, a fire started in a house because of a cigarette or something, wildfires. I mean, you'd think, surely human beings can control that and put that out. I mean, how is it so uncontrollable?
Do you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that I think in terms of the reasons, I think it's being caused by a particularly dry winter, the winds coming together, perfect storm. But I think the thing that interests me is exactly where you've taken it. And one of the things I've learned as an Englishman living in Canada for the past 6 years has been here, you know, we live in a fairly tame climate. Okay, we get some storms in the winter, there's some damage done, flooding, that kind of thing. North America, everything's on a much, much, much bigger scale.
Yeah.
And you're reminded on at least an annual basis when something happens, you're reminded that for all of our technology and all of our sophistication as human beings, nature can take a turn and suddenly you're confronted with your mortality and the sheer frailty of human civilization. It brings you up. It humbles you, I think, in the face of the power of something like this.
Yeah. And it's interesting, frailty of human civilization. I mean, I remember going camping in the west coast of Scotland and my tent one night, and then the storm came in. And I happened to read in the book of Job's, are not the cords of their tent pulled up? Are not they destroyed in the middle of the night? I mean, I thought, a word from the Lord. You know, my tent mates who weren't Christians were freaked out at my reading, but we were just so aware of the awesome power of nature. And for us, I think that's reflective of the awesome power of God. And
I think so. I was suddenly realizing I was talking about things that are on a smaller scale here. Of course, I've been camping in Scotland as well. And Scottish midges in the summer, you know, are certainly
they are a force of nature.
Up there with it being a force of nature. Yeah, I think you're right. It does, as a Christian, think about that. You think about that. It also, of course, raises the question of the implications of living in a world that's broken and fallen, that, you know, our relationship with creation is not as it should be. That's the heart of the biblical story.
Yeah.
The other thing that's come through the Fort McMurray disaster for me has been, you know, I'm incredibly proud, actually, of the way that many Canadian churches up there and Christian organizations have responded. Lots of other organizations have as well, and that's great. But particularly, to me, it's been a sign that when the church does what the church should be doing, because as God's people, we should be preaching the gospel, we should be, helping the homeless, dealing with our, you know, being a blessing to our communities. Yeah. And my word, of the Christian organizations there done that. And that's incredibly exciting. And I'm hoping there'll be some real gospel impact of that, with people seeing, you know, when life went badly wrong, my home was destroyed and I had nowhere to go, who was there for me but the church?
Yeah. I think that's great. Now, you travel the world quite a bit. You are a speaker for RSM. Have you ever been to Nigeria?
I haven't. I've been to North Africa, but not particularly to Nigeria. So,
okay.
No.
Okay. So Nigeria's been in the news in Britain. Do you know why Nigeria's been in the news? And I'll give you a clue. It's tied in with Afghanistan.
I was going to say, it's been in the news for all the wrong reasons. Corruption, hasn't it? It's been the accusation flung around.
Yeah. And the president of Nigeria, that was remarks made by David Cameron that were overheard, recorded on a microphone. We maybe say more about that later. But the president has responded. The president of Nigeria has responded. And I thought he responded very well. Did you hear what he said?
I didn't actually. So, okay. So go ahead.
Ah, let me say. Well, he basically admitted, of course, that there's corruption. And then he said, please, could you send back the billions that have been taken out of our country by corrupt people and put into British banks and trading companies and so on? Which I thought, it was just a great answer.
It's a brilliant response.
Yeah.
I think what I like about that, the response as well, it connects things, because I think one of the things that's interesting when it comes to corruption is very, very easy as individuals or as nations to point the finger. It's very easy to point the finger at, say, you know, Nigeria or India or Afghanistan or wherever and go, look, there's corruption, financial or political. We miss the corruption that goes on right under our noses. I mean, look at what's happened with the Panama Papers.
Yeah.
And it's been exposed there, or, you know, some of the practices that certain British banks have got up to across the years. But even then, it doesn't stop there, because it's very, very easy for me as an individual to sit here and go, well, the problem is corrupt politicians. The problem is the Tory party. Yeah. The problem is whatever.
Yeah.
And that neglects the fact, well, hang on, what about the corners that I cut?
Yeah.
You know, what about, and I think one of the powerful things, the challenging things about the gospel, of course, it allows us to name corruption and speak truth to power, but it also reminds us, hang on a moment, what about the corruption that's closer to home, that affects my life, your life? How do we deal with that?
Yeah, there's a very good example of that here in the city of Dundee, because for a while, my next door neighbour, who's a policeman, used to say he reckoned everyone in Dundee had at least 4 car radios, because people's cars were being broken into and car radios were being stolen. And I was thinking about that in terms of the corruption. I may not break into a car and steal someone's radio, but if I'm down the pub and paying £10 for a £100 radio from somebody who just gives it to me, actually, I'm as guilty as the person who's actually stealing the radio.
Or even the one example I sometimes use, okay, that's one example, but even there, it's possible to go, well, okay, I've never bought a dodgy car radio. Okay, let's bring it closer to home. You know, I got a chocolate craving, I go into the local newsagent. Oh, great, look, I can buy a bar of this particular chocolate, it's not very expensive. That's great. My sugar craving has been fulfilled. But why is that chocolate cheap?
Yeah.
Because some poor cocoa grower in the third world is being paid a penance to provide the resources to get my chocolate fix. All of us are implicated in this. And you know, I love that famous line about, you know, the dividing line between good and evil doesn't run between people, but the dividing line between good and evil runs right through the middle of every human heart.
Absolutely.
And it manifests itself in different ways in each one of us.
Absolutely. And we get found out, because the other thing, speaking of being overheard, Queen has upset the Chinese.
I read that story this morning in the bath of all places.
Okay.
So,
she said, well, what has she done?
Well, actually, what's interesting is the response, but the story is exactly. So she made a comment at I didn't catch the context of where she said it, but she made a comment at a kind of sort of state function about, she didn't entirely trust the Chinese and some questionable practices there.
They'd been rude at a particular diplomatic function when we had a Chinese state visit.
Yeah. And so she said this, and of course, she was overheard and it got reported in the British newspapers. Yeah. What was interesting, I don't know if you picked up on this, was the Chinese have now given their response.
Yeah.
And the Chinese response was effectively not to blame her.
Yeah.
They said, absolutely, she's a head of state. She's entitled to make criticisms, just as our leaders, and our diplomats, I'm sure, have said critiques about the British. She said, the problem is your press, that in China we don't...
We don't allow it.
We don't allow it. Which raised all kinds of questions there. Although, again, of course, what's interesting, I wasn't sure where you would think you've taken this, David. Again, I think I'm always interested in how what's going on in the political sphere and the cultural sphere interacts with the gospel sphere. And of course, again, you know, this reminds me of one of the truths of the gospel, that all of us at one point, the message of the gospel is clear. All of us, all of our private words and thoughts and desires will be laid exposed. And one of the things I find fascinating about the human condition is all of us try and build these masks and these walls and hold things back and hide things and to go, the idea that actually, you know, your secret thoughts might be exposed. It's quite daunting, actually.
Well, I think it's very daunting, and you know, you're good, because that's exactly where I was going to go. So that's great.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's perfect, because the one of the things about the internet is, I keep saying to people, what you write on the internet is forever, But actually, in scriptural terms, what you say, what you think is forever. And that is quite frightening, unless you are aware of the forgiveness of Christ and so on. So,
well, and connecting the two is fascinating, because I often like to, I always find this gets an interesting reaction, because I think a lot of Westerners that I meet don't like the idea of judgment.
Yeah.
And will speak very negatively about the idea of a God of judgment. I always like to respond and say, I actually think in Western culture right now, we live in the most judgmental civilization that has ever existed.
Amen.
If you say the wrong thing on Twitter, look how many politicians, how many celebrities.
That you've done.
Because now it's gone. And there are stories of people have lost careers, people have lost jobs, people have committed suicide over this kind of stuff. As you so beautifully put it, the gospel says that, yeah, everything you have ever thought, not just tweeted, will be exposed.
Yeah.
But yeah, we stand before a God who will judge us. But that God is not a God who wants to then drag us out there just to expose us and humiliate us. That God in Christ has gone, judgment has to come because he's a God of justice. But he's also a God of love and mercy and forgiveness, and has offered in the person of Christ to take that punishment on himself, and so that we can experience forgiveness. There is judgment in the gospel, there is judgment in the public square, there is forgiveness and grace and mercy offered in the gospel. I don't see that in the public square these days.
No, neither do I. And, you know, I've been looking at that in different ways. I mean, maybe one other subject I want to look at is the Scottish Parliament. I'm not going to ask you about your politics.
As an Englishman, I wouldn't dare say, but the Scottish Parliament, go ahead.
I was at a quite ancient ceremony, the kirking of the Scottish Parliament in St. Giles yesterday, and it was fascinating. Prince Charles was there, the great and the good. I've written quite a bit about it, which...
Were you there because you were great or good?
I was there because I'm the moderator of the Free Church, okay, and I got to sit right at the very back, which was great. I certainly wasn't allowed to participate, which would have been interesting, because it was kind of interfaith, and there were various things that struck me about that. But one I thought was almost the inherent contradiction. I think I came up with the conclusion at the end, we'd have been better not having a service of worship at all, because it ended up being quite synchronistic. And if there's anything that the Bible's against, it's synchronistic worship. And I also, I mean, hypocritical, because, for example, an imam was there and he was part of a service in which, for me, thankfully, Jesus was invoked as the Son of God, which to him is blasphemous. You know, and the Hindu scriptures were read and chanted, and the Quran and so on. And just, I don't know, there was just something about it that made me question whether this kind of synchronistic religion ends up being tolerant at all, whereas it doesn't end up destroying, you know, all true religion, and we end up creating a new one.
Do you know, there's a couple of things I want to say by response there, David. I mean, firstly, by way of context, I mean, I've been involved in particularly dialoguing and debating and reaching out to Muslims for 20 years now. My PhD is in Islam, so I've got a deep love of my Muslim friends, and I agree with some of what you've said there. Let me say a couple of things. Firstly, tolerance is interesting. I often like to get a reaction by saying, look, if I could remove one word from the dictionary, I would strike out the word tolerance. Tolerance is what you do to something that's beneath you and can't quite measure up to your standard. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter. When she leaves her toys strewn all over the floor and doesn't clear them up at bedtime, I tolerate that because she's 3.5. She can't do better. Or when the dog whittles on the sofa for the third time in a month, you tolerate it. It's a dog. It can't do any better. We don't tolerate human beings. We listen to human beings. We respect and we dialogue even when we disagree. I do not want to be respected by my Muslim tolerated by my Muslim friends or my atheist friends. I want to be respected. But that doesn't mean watering down. And in those 20 years that I've been engaging with Muslims, I am a great believer in the difference between interfaith and multi-faith.
Yeah.
Interfaith, correctly described, is when perhaps I might sit down with an imam. I do this quite often. Perhaps go to the mosque and we have a dialogue event, and he'll share his understanding. I'll share mine. They will be diametrically opposed. We have a Q&A from the audience, and we have a friendly but substantive discussion. That's interfaith, and it provokes great community relations, actually.
Yeah.
Multi-faith is when you come along and go, we've got to take all of these different positions and not talk about our differences, throw them together, stir them up, and pretend that we're all the same thing. As you so rightly put, that denigrates the gospel, and it denigrates my Muslim friends. And it denigrates atheism. I mean, humanists must have been sitting there last night thinking, what the heck's going on here?
Well, except they were there, which is quite funny, because they were there as representatives of a faith, which is what I've been arguing all the time, that humanism is a faith.
Well,
so,
you and I agree on that entirely. So there
bingo.
We are. Chapter
so I got
two of my book.
Listen, we have run out of time. I have so much more I would love to talk about, and Al is filming us just now, so I would love to talk about the Tate Gallery and why I was down there. We might do that next week. The European election. I'm not going to ask if you're in or out, but you and I both love Private Eye.
Oh, yeah.
And we're actually filming this, so for the benefit of those who are just listening to it, I'm showing Al a picture of how Britain will look after Brexit, which, according to David Cameron, which is basically Dante's Inferno. it's just brilliant. I mean, the hyperbole surrounding this whole debate.
I think just very quickly, he's been misinterpreted. When he says it will lead to World War III, he means within the Conservative Party.
Yeah. I liked that one. Actually, you know this. I think this might be, I mean, apart from saying thank you to, this often happens to us in Scotland. People in America assume that we're English. So you're from Canada. The American elections, that's part of your... you must be looking in just total astonishment.
I think the average Canadian is looking across the border going, what the heck? And then as a Brit, I would say, what I'm now saying to American friends is going, you know what? If you guys want to consider rejoining the Commonwealth...
You can have our queen.
Yeah, the door is always open. We can just forget about that little Tea Party incident.
Yeah, I've got to, Private Eye, I've got to finish with this because I thought they were two of the funniest things. Aging socialist wows US. In the most unprecedented scenes in U.S. political history, Hillary Clinton conceded defeat to the man who came from nowhere. The self-styled socialist who seemed too old to lead a modern political party has captured the imagination of young people and generated a new sense of enthusiasm and purpose in a moribund political system. Jeremy Corbyn has done it again and surprised everyone by winning over the voters of New Hampshire and romping home in the primary, said one of his top aides, Ken Livingston Siegel. No one expected this result, given that Jeremy wasn't even in the running or the country. But mark my words, Corbyn mania will sweep Jeremy to power as the next president of the United States. Now, that was great, but this was even better.
Brilliantly written.
I'm not going to. Republicans settle on stop Trump candidate. The Republicans have finally settled on a single establishment candidate who will hopefully stop Trump becoming the Republican choice in the presidential race. Hillary Clinton is the ideal choice, said one Republican Party insider dousing a Planned Parenthood clinic with paraffin. She's right-wing. She's a foreign policy hawk. She believes in big money and lots of Democrats hate her. We're sure she'll want to be our preferred candidate. We believe she might soon have enough time in her hands to accept our offer. It's just great.
You can't make this up. this is great stuff.
You can't. You know, the thing is that Private Eye does some very serious stuff, doesn't it? And yeah, it's comedy stuff. Sometimes you look and you say they're predicting what's going to happen in the future. It's sad. It's great to have you here in Scotland. We hope to have you back, Andy.
Wonderful, David. It's been great to be with you.
Thank you. Great. And we shall, you shall hear from us all next week. God bless.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens, trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.